and people did not care with what happened with Bilkis Banu. In fact, the courts termed Bilkis Banu's case as an act of revenge, while Nirbhaya's rape was called a rarest of the rare crime, and therefore the vilest punishment was meted out to the criminals. So this massive difference in judgments by the court of law tells us that law is definitely not equal, and if the law is not equal, then there will be travesties of justice like one after the other.
Mrs. Ahmed, the men were garlanded and offered sweets by the members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in Gujarat upon their release. Now, could we say that this could set a dangerous precedent?
I think a dangerous precedent was set when Modi was elected as the Prime Minister of India, because he was the one who incited the entire violence that happened in 2002 in Gujarat. He paraded the bodies of the Hindus who died at the Sabarmati train burning, and then he encouraged self-respecting Hindus to avenge those deaths. And therefore, when these people are released, it only shows that Modi is doing what he promised. He promised that he's going to right the wrongs that have been committed against the Hindus in the past. And by releasing these rapists, which even the court termed were good Brahmins of good sanskar, Brahmin is an upper caste Hindu in the levels of Hindu castes. So when these people are released, Modi is only doing what he promised to do. So a dangerous precedent had been set when he was elected, and everything else that followed is only a natural consequence of that decision.
Now, Mrs. Ahmed, interestingly, they were freed on the day India was celebrating its Independence Day and hours after Prime Minister Modi spoke of women's empowerment. Now, is it fair to say that the BJP government in India has failed minority Muslims?
It has definitely failed minority Muslims and definitely Muslim women. But then again, releasing them on the day of Indian independence does not say that it's ironical or even out of sync. It is not at all in the Hindu imagination that is, perpetuating right now in India. It is completely in sync with what is happening. As I said, Muslims here are not even considered humans. When they're not humans, it's hard to consider them as Muslim, as women. So a Muslim woman is not looked at as a woman. She is a Muslim, and she probably had to go through this tragedy. No one's conscience is being shaken when this is happening. So, it's not ironical that this happened on Independence Day. In fact, it feels like it was part of a plan, and it completely worked. On one hand, he's talking about feminine empowerment. On the other hand, these rapists are being released, clearly emboldening the fact that there will be women empowerment, and there'll be an empowerment of Hindu upper caste women, while Muslim women should not even be considered women.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Ahmed, research scholar and assistant professor at the University of Delhi, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Activist Yogita Bahayana says she has written a letter to Chief Justice of India demanding that 11 accused in Bilkis Banu case be sent back to jail, adding that it's happening with every Bilkis who fights for justice. Arfa Khanum Sherwani, a senior journalist, asked why Bilkis Banu's honor is less than any other Indian woman and why it doesn't shake the conscience of 1.3 billion Indians. Firebrand Indian parliamentarian Mahuya Moitra questions the loudmouth self-righteous TV anchors who haven't deemed the issue important enough to be discussed.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
All almost a fortnight after marking the Chabahar Day and reaffirming his country's vision of making the Shahid Beheshti port in Iran's Chabahar a regional transit hub, Indian Minister of Ports, Shipping and Waterways Sarbananda Sonowal visited Iran just recently to assess the progress of the port's first phase of operationalization. The port, situated in southeastern Iran, has emerged as an important commercial transit hub and an economic route for India to reach landlocked countries such as Afghanistan, bypassing Pakistani ports.
Indian Minister of Ports, Shipping and Waterways Sarbananda Sonowal, who visited the Chabahar port during his four-day official tour of Iran earlier this week, said New Delhi is committed to the development of the strategic port, which sits at the mouth of the Gulf of Oman, into a regional and international transit hub. He informed that since India assumed operations of the port, it has handled over 4.8 million tons of bulk cargo, with shipments coming from countries such as Australia, Brazil, Romania, Russia, Ukraine, Thailand, Uzbekistan, etc. During the Indian minister's visit, the two sides agreed to form a joint technical committee to ensure the smooth functioning of the port. Sonowal said New Delhi and Tehran are working towards making the international north-south transport corridor the preferred route of trade between the two regions. He also handed over 6 mobile harbor cranes to the port authorities, aimed at further development of the port that has emerged as a key area of economic cooperation between Tehran and New Delhi despite U.S. sanctions. Iran's Deputy President Mohammad Mukhber, in his meeting with the visiting Indian official, emphasized boosting investments in the Chabahar port and said Iran welcomes the participation of foreign investments in the development of the port.
Chabahar port is a transit gateway in southeastern Iran's Sistan-Baluchistan province that has emerged as an important regional and international transit hub in recent years, bringing India and Iran closer despite the ominous shadow of U.S. sanctions. Known for its strategic location, the port connects the Indian subcontinent with landlocked Afghanistan and Central Asian countries, offering attractive opportunities for cooperation between regional countries. The Indian minister's recent visit to Iran again shows how this port is defining geopolitics.
Indian Foreign Minister S. Jaishankar, in a newspaper interview last week, said the Chabahar port remains relevant and a logistical route for Indian supplies to Central Asia and Afghanistan. The statement was an affirmation of how seriously India takes the development of the strategic Iranian port despite the U.S. pressure and bullying. The interaction between India and Iran on the port started back in 2003, but it took more than a decade for them to make a concerted push, resulting in the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding in May 2015 for the development of the port and railways. This MOU translated into a formal 10-year contract for equipping and operating the strategic port that was executed during the Indian Prime Minister's visit to Tehran in May 2016. It was followed by Iran, India, and Afghanistan signing a trilateral agreement for the transportation of goods through the port. The activation of the contract faced multiple delays due to U.S. sanctions and New Delhi's reluctance to antagonize Washington. In February 2018, during then-Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's visit to New Delhi, the two sides entered into a short-term agreement to operationalize the port. In late 2018, India officially assumed the operations of parts of the port.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Hussein Askari, Southwest Asia Coordinator for the International Schiller Institute from Stockholm. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Askari. Now, Chabahar Port has emerged as a regional transit hub with shipments from different countries passing through it. Now, how important is it in the context of Iran's relations with India in particular and the region in general?
Yeah, I think the Chabahar port is one of the most important strategic ports in the, can say, in the Indian Ocean and the whole region. Not the only one, but it's one of the very important ones, although it's still in the beginning of its function. What is important here is that, I mean, for India and Iran, India sees Iran as a very important bridge, especially if you look at Iran geographically. Iran is on the Indian Ocean, but it's also located on the Caspian Sea and on the Gulf. Then you have Iran connected to the Indian subcontinent by land, Central Asia, the Caucasus, its neighbor, maritime neighbor of Russia, but also connected to Europe through Turkey. And of course, we have through Iraq and Syria to the Mediterranean. So this makes Iran a very unique geographically, you know, positioned country in the world and for the world economy, but also for the region. And that's why India considers Iran as a very special partner in this sense.
Mr. Asghari, Indian Minister of Ports, Shipping and Waterways, during his more recent visit to Iran, reaffirmed his country's commitment to the development of the strategic port. So what makes it so significant for New Delhi?
I think India has, I mean, they had a setback in Afghanistan because India was very much involved in Afghanistan, whereby the whole connection through Chabahar to Afghanistan was very significant. But after the withdrawal of the U.S. and NATO from Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover, India faced a setback. But now India is looking beyond Afghanistan, although it hasn't given up on that, into Central Asia and also to Russia. And therefore, India sees this as a very important connection, a bridge to Central Asia, to Russia, and further on. I mean, you have to think that India is not any country. India is going to be, or is already, the third largest economy in the world. And it has a specific economic space it can legitimately take in the world and in the region. I don't like the geopolitical discussions about, you know, circumventing Pakistan, working against China and the Belt and Road. I think it's very important that India and the Indian economy is integrated into this whole region. It's important to note that while Mr. Sonowal, Minister of Port and Shipping, was in Iran, the National Security Advisor of the President of India, or the Prime Minister of India, was a meeting with representatives from Central Asia. We also had a summit meeting between Mr. Modi and the leaders of the Central Asian nations. So India is looking at Central Asia as a very important economic partner, and these countries also look at India as an economic partner. But Iran will be the bridge from between India and those countries.
Mr. Asghari, India has also proposed to include the Chabahar port in the framework of the international north-south transport corridor. Now, will it give a boost to the regional connectivity?
I think the world has changed so much in the recent months that this, although the north-south transport corridor, international transport corridor, has been there for many years as an idea, but now it has taken a very specific role as India is getting closer to Russia after the Ukraine crisis, and India did not submit to pressure from the United States and Europe to break ties with Russia and not import oil and gas. And therefore, it has become a significant aspect. But concerning connectivity, you have to look at this region. I mean, you look at the demographics, first of all. You have 200 million people, and more than 200 million in Pakistan. We have 80 million in Iran. We have in Turkey, 80 million. We have in Central Asia, although less. But these countries, these population, Afghanistan, 30 million, these populations are disconnected by large swaths of land, void, like deserts and other areas that need to be connected. You cannot connect the economies of those nations and the resources of these nations and connect them further to the world if you don't build a very efficient infrastructure like transport network, gas and oil pipeline network between all these countries. That would be a very important part, and all these roads, so to speak, will meet in Iran.
Last but not least, Mr. Asghari, is the development of the Chabahar port, as well as growing connectivity between Iran and regional countries, another sign of how miserably U.S. sanctions have failed?
Yes, the whole policy of the West, the United States and the British, NATO, the whole geopolitical game, the great game, has crumbled, actually, since the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But now we have, for example, under the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, we have a completely new constellation of forces, economic, strategic forces coming together, and no sanctions will help. I mean, I hope the sanctions against Iran will be lifted and a nuclear agreement is reached. This will be useful for Europe and the other countries. But despite of that, we have now a new economic block in Eurasia, which is connected through the Belt and Road Initiative, the North-South International Corridor, and the Eurasian Economic Union. All these three infrastructure initiatives, if they come together, if we get rid of geopolitics, if India and Pakistan become friends again, if we can connect Iran, Pakistan, and India with oil and gas pipelines, we can connect Russia to the Indian subcontinent. If we remove all these geopolitical problems, there will be a solid economic bloc all the way from East Asia to Central Europe, Belarus at least, and also into the Mediterranean through Iraq, Syria, and the Gulf countries.
There you have it, Mr. Askari, Southwest Asia Coordinator for the International Schiller Institute from Stockholm. Thank you for being on the program, Mr. Askari. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sarbanand Sonowal, India's shipping minister, during his recent visit to Iran, said Prime Minister Modi was committed to make Chabahar Port a regional trade, transit, and international connectivity hub. Sidhan Sibal, an Indian journalist, shares pictures of India's shipping minister calling on Iran's Vice President Mohammad Mukhbir and Roads Minister Rostam Qasemi, saying the key focus is on use of Chabahar port. New Delhi-based journalist Rishikesh Kumar tweets about India handing over 6 mobile harbor cranes to Indian Ports Global Chabahar Free Trade Zone, saying it will expedite the work at Chabahar port.
And that was our episode about the controversy generated by the release of men accused of gang raping a Muslim woman in India, and also how the Chabahar port has emerged as an important regional transit hub and a key area of cooperation between India and Iran. Now, so till then, take great care. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing currently on the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam is explaining about the truth and the falsehood and about wilaya, basically the authority. And these are important discussions in any government. You see, because truth and falsehood, they're terminologies that are very much mingling with the idea of authority. You see, why does falsehood want to spread? And what is the reason why people who hold on to falsehood want to spread? It's because they want to have some form of authority. And in fact, if they want to spread, they need that authority. to be able to spread and continue their authority. So always, for something to exist and continue to exist and thrive, some level of authority is required. Truth in the same way. Truth also is also very much linked with authority. Because for the truth to remain, for people who love the truth to continue their path, they need some level of authority. They need some type of guidance from a higher source to tell them how and when to continue this path of truth. So that authority is necessary. That authority is what we call wilaya. And this is something very important. Some people are in the wilaya of the good people, of the imams, of the prophets. Some are in the wilaya of the shaitan, of the bad people, the evil people. So we need to separate this truth and falsehood very clearly and understand that, so that we are always under the authority of the righteous. When you talk about the idea of wilaya, when you talk about wilaya, we say authority, isn't it? And we discussed about it in the previous segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, the idea of understanding the truth, of recognizing the truth, of following the truth is very critical for the right type of authority to remain in a community, in a society. And therefore, wilaya means to very clearly, in clear terms, announce your connection with the truth, with the true path, with reality. First of all, by understanding the truth, and then by following it and announcing your clear stance. Not by being vague and saying that there is a middle path and, you know, we can, you know, still kind of take advantage of the truth and at the same time be in the falsehood. There is nothing like this. When a person plays around, okay, and they take part of the book and they leave part of the book, these people, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says, "Humul kafiruna haqqa." They are the actual disbelievers. So there is no middle path. There is no, for example, trying to compromise with the truth and falsehood at times, you know, to kind of get a leeway in certain desires or certain feelings or certain things that we want. This clear attestation and a clear declaration and following in the path within a person's nafs, first of all, within himself, in his mind, in his heart, and in the society, is something that is really going to put a person in the right form of wilaya. And actually, this was the point where Imam Ali alayhi salam was very worried about. Okay, now, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, was brought to power, he deserved it from first, but then people finally recognized that, you know, he's the best, and they what mistakes they had done with regards to the Ahlul Bayt. When so many people came like a flood into his house and they tried to push him here and there and like make him the leader and it, you are the person that we need and everything. Suddenly there was a whole, you know, there was a rush towards the truth. There was a massive, revolutionary feeling, an attachment and, you know, inclination towards the truth. But Imam Ali alayhi salam was seeing something beyond this apparent, clamor that was happening. And he was seeing something inside, something within, which was more sinister and subtle.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We say that Imam Ali alayhi salam was seeing beyond this apparent clamor that was happening. And he was seeing beyond that. He was seeing that these people are apparently showing interest in the path of truth. But it seems like there was something hidden. There was a sinister, deep and disregard of the truth. Beyond this apparent layer of inclination towards the truth. And Imam Ali alayhi salam knew that. And the only time when these things became clear is when Imam Ali alayhi salam started to make some firm steps against those people who are after, you know, the glamour of this world and wanted just power and authority under the auspices of Imam Ali alayhi salam's authority. And that is the time when people realize, oh, for example, Talha, for example, Zubair, what their actual intentions were, Muawiyah, some other people who looked very good in the community. But then people realized, Imam Ali alayhi salam also would try his best to guide these people. But unfortunately, some people were just not listening. Yes, Imam Ali alayhi salam had a spiritual influence, but if people accept that influence, isn't it? If people are ready, there were big barriers that were stopping people from understanding the truth, from listening to the beautiful statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And that is why Imam Ali alayhi salam was emphasizing in the very first sermons that he, before coming to power, is to clearly identify the boundaries of truth and falsehood and to have that awareness so that people are strong enough when the right decisions are taken by Imam Ali alayhi salam and they stick to the true path and not get confused. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, Allah. که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's statements at the gathering of the ulama of west of Tehran, October 22, 1969. Up to this moment that we are gathered here, Islam has been maintained by the grace of the Master of Martyrs, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The Master of Martyrs gave his all for Islam in the path of Allah. He had no worldly things to give, but he offered himself, his young ones, and his disciples. He rose in support of Islam to oppose tyranny. He imposed the empire of these days, which were more vehement than mother imperial regimes. He rose up against the tyrant of his day with very few fellow warriors. And though he and his men were all martyred, he was victorious in overthrowing that missionary of cruelty and oppression.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. In one of his sayings, he says, essentially, culture forms the identity and existence of a society. With a pervert culture, no matter how powerful a community may be, economically, politically, industrially, and militarily, that community is vain, empty, and hollow. Well, as we said in our previous program, culture is what the people believe in. Culture is what, you know, the values people hold valuable in their lives. And these days, the prevalent culture of people is materialism and consumerism. You know, paying your attention on the carnal aspect of life has turned to everything that matters in life. To eat well, dress well, look perfect is something that people are focusing most of their energy and time on.
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
Living on the surface of life has become very popular. What do I mean by the surface of life? I mean, only the superficial aspect of life is what matters to many people. Their inner richness and personal qualities have secondary importance. And that is why there is so much depression and anxiety in the lives of people. People have everything in life materially, but they're not happy. They have little inner peace. So with this kind of society where there is a poor culture and spirituality doesn't matter much, there is this kind of emptiness in the lives of people. Hope that these contemplations were fruitful to you. Don't forget to join us for our next episode of the program Spring of Truth. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day.
Economic Divide.
Europe's energy crisis is far from over, but Europe has another big worry to deal with, and that is the upcoming winter, when it's predicted to be extremely cold. How will its citizens deal with not only a high energy cost, but energy rationing? The term heat or eat is no joke when it comes to the European state of affairs on top of inflation. Hi, I'm Kavit Afwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. In this program, we will take a look at Europe's energy crunch. High gas bills, one of the outcomes, Europe to ration energy, something that is now real. Tough winter is projected ahead. Next up, we will take a look at Europe's cost of living crisis. We've covered this before in this program, worth reviewing again when you take a look at things like high inflation and also low purchasing power as a result of high inflation, amongst other prices that is biting into the pocketbook of Europeans. And finally, EU politicians, what are they doing? Well, in essence, they are sacrificing their own citizens. They're not pushing for diplomacy when it comes to the Ukraine conflict. And as a result, an economic crisis has unfolded for them.
As the crisis between Russia and the West heats up, fears are growing in Europe of a gloomy winter. There are now concerns that Russia could turn the gas tap off to Europe. Prices are already high in Europe and the UK.
There is potentially a double parallel between Britain today and Britain in 1973 and thereabouts, in that the inflation which took off in Britain in 1973 and stayed high for the rest of the decade was the first impulse towards inflation was a combination of domestic forces because of global energy crisis.
Households in Germany will have to pay almost 500 euros more a year for gas.
There is no relief for Europe and its citizens when it comes to their economic state of affairs. They simply can't keep up or do anything about their money losing its value at this point in time. And that is very evident when you take a look at some online posts on this matter. And then with winter coming, things are looking pretty bad for them. Our first online post, winter in Europe may be springtime for Putin. Taking a look at this entry, we go into the source where it says winter in Europe may be springtime for Putin. Russia's energy war deploys high prices to promote social turmoil and to empower populist parties. Next up, Europe seems to be getting exactly what the U.S. thought Russia was getting, an economic squeeze so bad that it topples leaders. Ouch, that hurts. Then German and French electricity are at record highs of 532 euros per megawatt hour for Germany and 690 euros per megawatt hour for France. Europe on the verge of an energy crisis, and it will be a very cold winter for the region. Then finally, natural gas is being stored and demand is being curbed, but it's far too early to call an end to Europe's fears of a cold, dark winter plagued by blackouts. Now, welcome to Europe's Dark Cold Winter, Elements by Julian Lee, in which it says replenishing storage and reducing demand still may not be enough. So obviously all the online posts that we just reviewed show how bad Europe is going to do and their citizens come winter. Okay, let's bring in our guests for this segment of the Q&A. Our first guest is Malachi Steenson. He's a lawyer and political activist. Malachi Steenson, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at Europeans, they are looking at a really tough winter ahead, of which then the news of gas rationing and energy rationing in particular is what they have announced, and this has actually gone into effect. The shortage in energy to have affected deeply, for example, the UK, where electric bills have tripled. When you take a look at rationing, that really has a shocking ring to it. And of course, the immediate question is when that happens, how will that affect the economy of countries like Germany and the UK?
Well,
I think if we look particularly at Ireland, we're seeing the very same thing, where we're seeing, you know, huge increases in both electricity, gas and oil prices. And I think that the oil companies and the utility companies are using the Ukrainian crisis in order to jack up prices to consumers and to increase profits. I mean, at one hand, they're telling us that the price of these commodities is increasing. Yet at the same time as they increase the price to consumers, their profits are going up by huge margins. So it seems to me there's a certain amount of price gouging in the whole business. I think that the West and the EU in particular are using the Ukrainian crisis in order to bring in further controls on population. I mean, again, if you look at Ireland, we're told we're going to have energy blackouts during the next winter. But at the same time, our economic policy is geared towards bringing in, for instance, more data centres, which are huge users of electricity in particular, huge users of water resources. And there's no reluctance to say, well, if we're going to be short of electricity and power, then we shouldn't be bringing in these big consumers.
Okay, let me introduce our next guest, Karel Veres. Ken joins us. Karel is the VP of the French party by the name of Solidarity and Progress, or Progrès, as they say in French. Karel, welcome to Economic Divide. Europe is forecast to begin this winter with historically low amounts of diesel. And my focus on this question is diesel that powers large parts of the economy in European countries, used for cars, trucks, etc. Now, when you take a look at the way that this actually obviously is one of the components behind the way that the economy and its wheel turn, how will this be supplied if the supplies of diesel are at their lowest this time of the year when it continued from the year 2008?
Well, on the gas situation, there are deals with Azerbaijan, Norway, and Algeria. On the oil, it's probably more complicated because there are all kinds of tricks which are being used by various countries to counter the sanctions. For example, India is buying a lot of Russian oil, which is very cheap, with special discounts, like China also. But India eventually could sell it to other partners in other countries, which then in turn can sell it to the US and to Europe. So everything depends to what degree, you know, the police, the media police and the financial police of the institutions connected to the central banks, will they really impose their policies? But you're absolutely right that diesel is a very clean and cheap energy and efficient energy, and taking it down will only lower the productivity, and then lower productivity means increasing chances of recession, depression, and bankruptcy.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we bring you news with an economic flavor from around the world. Our first item is something to do with kids, the cost of kids. That's right, that has made news, the price of parenthood in the age of inflation. Now, this particular one is for the U.S., where it costs at least $300,000 per kid to raise them. Now, what have they done to come up with that figure? They have factored in the cost of inflation, where it said that a child costs more than a pretty penny for the average American. That price used to be roughly around $200,000 to $250,000. So obviously there was a huge increase when it comes to the cost of kids and raising them. Next up, something that the EU doesn't want to hear about. It's EU bankruptcies from businesses. More EU firms are facing that bleak situation. According to Eurostat, the number of petitions for insolvency has grown for a fourth consecutive quarter. Bankruptcy declarations has increased by 2.2% in the April to June period for the year 2022. Another blow to the European economy. And the next up, a piece of news that came out regarding Canada and Canadian worker abuse, where you have a fight that has ramped up to prevent Canadian companies from abusing these workers abroad. Canadian companies have been accused of being complicit in alleged rights abuses and environmental harms. Now, that obviously has to deal with companies that deal with minerals or resources of that nature. And our final look goes to Dubai and the inflation in there. Consumer prices there have rocketed to its highest after years of actual deflation. Maybe you didn't know, but just 3 years ago, Dubai was experiencing the sharpest deflation in the region, peaking at 3.9% annually in February of 2019. So it shows at this point how that has rebounded, it's gone the opposite way to towards inflation. Those were the topics we picked. Hope you liked them. If you have any particular piece of news that you'd like to share with us from where you are at, please do send them to us.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for an in-depth section of the program. The energy crisis in Europe is real. Many Europeans will not be able to afford their heating bill this winter. And that's going to have severe consequences, unintended ones, for European officials and their countries. Social unrest not that far off. Some have speculated that is what's going to happen. Well, let's take a look at some of the reasons why something like that may occur. Now, electricity prices for the year 2021, Spain and Portugal, 411% increase. I mean, that's a lot, isn't it, for countries to experience that much of an increase. Greece has experienced a 343% increase in their electricity wholesale prices. And also France, which comes in at 336%. A lot. And also, we're looking at other countries that maybe we didn't have time to put here. Last one here, Italy. This has come in at 318%. And this is directly coming from the European Commission in terms of the figures and the increase that you see over here. Now, as energy prices surge, while wages remain unchanged, or maybe just a slight increase, some are living from salary to salary based on what has occurred. And they're being forced to actually decide whether to spend their limited funds on keeping the lights on in their homes or filling the fridge. This is where the term heat or eat has become a catchword for Europeans. That's the stark reality that they're facing. All right, next, energy ministers. Well, they had to do something. They've reached a deal on an EU-wide reduction in gas, which is something they came up with, 15% across the board. They said this first phase will be voluntary based on coordination or fuel switching, temperature limits, and information campaigns. But we have to wait and see whether that can actually be a blanket application for all European countries. That's key over there. Next up, this is something that's really incredible. Now, they're facing an energy crisis, okay? So what they're going to do, they are actually announced it. They're prepared to drive up the cost of everyone's heating bills. How is that going to happen? Well, they're going to secure their supply of natural gas for the upcoming winter. But according to the European Union officials, whatever the world market can pay for a tanker transporting a supercooled form of, like, fossil fuel across international waters, Europe will be willing to top it. That's right. So whatever price is out there, they said this formally, made the announcement, we're going to pay a higher price. So there you have it. You have the citizens of these countries that are going to pay higher for that. Let's bring back Malachi Stinson, who's a lawyer and political activist, to see what he thinks about this. Malachi Stinson, welcome back. The EU has agreed to ration gas. That's one of the things that it said it will do. But some countries obviously have put up a fight because every country has its own particular needs when it comes to energy. And, of course, these energy sanctions against Russia are biting their economies. How fragile is this unity against Russia, do you think, at this point, as the economies are tanking and people are suffering?
At the same time, we're telling people, because of climate change and the other the agenda that they're using there to control people, we're saying that you must switch to electric cars. And at the same time, we're telling people, well, you're going to have electrical shortages. You're not going to be able to charge your car. So you're going to be, just like they used COVID to ensure that people were brought under a communist-type control in their countries, where they were afraid to go out the doors, where they were told, you know, that Armageddon was coming and the world was about to end. We're told the same with climate change. And, you know, as Michael O'Leary, the CEO of Ryanair, said the other day, that these people are telling us, for instance, what the temperature would be in 100 years, and they can't tell us what next Tuesday's weather will be like. So it seems to me to be a whole agenda being pursued, which is not in the interest of the ordinary consumer, and it's not in the interest of the ordinary member of the public. It's a policy that's being pursued, on one hand, to create and move capital into fewer and fewer hands, and also at the same time to move power into this European federal state almost, and into the powers of unelected bureaucrats.
Okay, let's see what Karel Veresken thinks. He's the VP of the French party, Solidarity and Progress, who rejoins us. Karel, welcome back. A month ago, we saw how Europe was facing an energy rationing scheme, which it says it's going to enact as the tough winter, which has been predicted is going to be tough, is looming. You're looking at the shortage that has really catapulted gas prices and energy prices into a whole nother level, like in the UK, where it's tripled. Germany is also affected very severely. What effects will this rationing, when it really goes into full-fledged execution, have on the economy of these countries?
Well, it's a fast trip to disaster, because it's there is an alignment of several planets which are predicting that this will lead us to total collapse. First of all, for the European economy, it means losing the market in Russia, which for some factors in some areas is very important. Secondly, we're losing the arrival of raw materials for the production. Three, the higher cost of energy, because we'll bring down productivity. The model of the reconstruction of Europe after the war is to have cheap energy and invested in highly productive industry and agriculture. For example, people in Germany talk about the end of the German model, because they will not have the cheap energy to build machines they can export and sell for high prices. Then on top of this, we have the drought, which is slowing down our nuclear power plants, which cannot be cooled, notably in France. But also it is impacting transport, like the Danube and the Rhine River. The Rhine is now below 40 centimeters, which means a lot of shipping inland, waterways cannot really function.
The industrial Northwest Europe is likely to face diesel shortages this winter. Diesel power covers large parts of the economy. Diesel shortages, along with falling levels of heating oil, could further weaken the economy and to prompt more protests across the continent. Gas rationings and possible shutdowns could potentially trigger social unrest and dissatisfaction among the poorer sections of European societies. Strikes have already erupted in several countries, including the UK, Belgium, and Spain. Governments are aware that people are struggling, and they know that things will get worse in the coming months.
I think our problem now is a lack of knowledge. We don't have anybody around
in politics who can remember what it was like with inflation. Certainly not in office, and indeed many of them not at all, because you know, this is quite a young generation of politicians we have up now. So I think there's a danger in possibly in the other direction. The people are slightly lost.
We have told you about Europe's energy problem, but perhaps no country in Europe is facing an energy crisis like Germany. Let us count the reason why. The scale of the problem for Germany is so big that this headline reads a doomsday scenario. According to Bloomberg, Germany is at a risk of deindustrialization. It states that soaring power prices may trigger an exodus of factories from the country. Prices for gas and electricity in Germany have reportedly more than doubled in the past 2 months. There's another point that is not covered when it comes to Germany, and that is how they have moved to green energy from a long time ago under a program called Energiewende. Energiewende gained legislative support in 2010, and Germany spent over 202 billion euros on renewable energy projects from 2013 to 2020. Since 2010, the share of German electricity generation that has come from solar and wind power has risen from 8% to 31%. Now Germany may reopen its coal plants that it had shut down. They have no choice in order to safeguard their economy and national security. Don't forget, coal is the dirtiest source of electricity. Nevertheless, Germany has told its citizens that they have to face the stark truth when it comes to energy use. The German government has urged its citizens to lower energy use. They require citizens to turn down their air conditioners and use less hot water. Let's end this segment by bringing up another point that is the following. What are the safest and cleanest sources of energy? Fossil fuels are the dirtiest and most dangerous energy sources, while nuclear and modern renewable energy sources are vastly safer and cleaner. The differences are huge. So it is quite hypocritical of Western governments to tell Iran to stop its civilian use of nuclear energy. That does it for this segment. Hope you found it useful.
When European countries began confronting Russia after Russia's special military operation against Ukraine, did they really know what they were getting themselves into? I mean, first of all, let's be clear, I'm not trying to justify the war or the death of civilians. But as the war dragged on, did the Europeans really want to continue down this path, one in which they are now facing things like lack of food, inflation, or high energy costs? Even now, do they want a political solution for the sake of at least not ruining their economies, let alone their citizens? Or are they following the U.S. diktats while risking a potential either Third World War or, worse yet, a nuclear catastrophe? These are key questions that the European officials need to deal with. We'll find out, hopefully sooner than later, what they decide. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikhail Tatlay and team, looking forward to seeing you next week.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed.